when the bright wind from the west blew on his face, and he looked out at the high horizon, he said, "That's good." "Let me get some people from the village to make a litter and carry you," she said. "They're all waiting to do something for you." "I want to walk," the old man said. Tharu came around the house and watched solemnly as Ogeon and Tenar went step by step, and stopping every 5 or 6 steps for Ogeon to gasp, across the tangled meadow towards the woods that climbed steep up the mountainside from the inner side of the clifftop. The sun was hot and the wind cold. It took them a very long time to cross that meadow. Ogeon's face was gray, and his legs shook like the grass in the wind, when they got at last to the foot of a big young beech tree just inside the forest, a few yards up the beginning of the mountain path. There he sank down between the roots of the tree, his back against its trunk. For a long time he could not move or speak, and his heart, pounding and faltering, shook his body. He nodded finally and whispered, "All right." Tharu had followed them at a distance. Tenar went to her and held her and talked to her a little. She came back to Ogeon. "She's bringing a rug," she said. "Not cold." "I'm cold." There was the flicker of a smile on her face. The child came, lugging a goat's wool blanket. She whispered to Tenar and ran off again. "Heather will let her help milk the goats and look after her," Tenar said to Ogeon, "so I can stay here with you." "Never one thing for you," he said in the hoarse whistling whisper that was all the voice he had left. "No, always at least 2 things, and usually more," she said. "But I am here." He nodded. For a long time he did not speak, but sat back against the tree trunk, his eyes closed. Watching his face, Tenar saw it change as slowly as the light changed in the west. He opened his eyes and gazed through a gap in the thickets at the western sky. He seemed to watch something, some act or deed, in that far, clear, golden space of light. He whispered once, hesitant, as if unsure, "The dragon..." The sun was down, the wind fallen. Ogeon looked at Tenar. "Over," he whispered with exultation. "All changed. Changed, Tenar. Wait. Wait here for..." A shaking took his body, tossing him like the branch of a tree in a great wind. He gasped, his eyes closed and opened, gazing beyond her. He laid his hand on hers. She bent down to him. He spoke his name to her, so that after his death he might be truly known. He gripped her hand and shut his eyes, and began once more the struggle to breathe until there was no more breath. He lay then like one of the roots of the tree, while the stars came out and shone through the leaves and branches of the forest. Tenar sat with the dead man in the dusk and dark. A lantern gleamed like a firefly across the meadow. She had laid the woolen blanket across them both, but her hand that held his hand had grown cold as if it held a stone. She touched her forehead to his hand once more. She stood up, stiff and dizzy, her body feeling strange to her, and went to meet and guide whoever was coming with the light. That night, his neighbors sat with Ogeon, and he did not send them away. The mansion house of the Lord of Rhaelbi stood on an outcrop of rocks on the mountainside above the Overfell. Early in the morning, long before the sun had cleared the mountain, the wizard in the service of that lord came down through the village, and very soon after, another wizard came toiling up the steep road from Gaunt Port, having set out in darkness. Word had come to them that Ogeon was dying, or their power was such that they knew of the passing of a great mage. The village of Rhaelbi had no sorcerer, only its mage, and a witch-woman to perform the lowly jobs of finding and mending and bone-setting, which people would not bother the mage with. Auntie Moss was a dour creature, unmarried like most witches, and unwashed, with graying hair tied in curious charm knots, and eyes red-rimmed from herb smoke. It was she who had come across the meadow with the lantern, and with Tenar and the others she had watched the night by Ogeon's body. She had set a wax candle in a glass shade there in the forest, and had burned sweet oils in a dish of clay. She had said the words that should be said, and done what should be done. When it came to touching the body to prepare it for burial, she had looked once at Tenar as if for permission, and then had gone on with her offices. Village witches usually saw to the homing, as they called it, of the dead, and often to the burial. When the wizard came down from the mansion house, a tall young man with a silvery staff of pine wood, and the other one came up from Gauntport, a stout, middle-aged man with a short yew staff, Auntie Moss did not look at them with her bloodshot eyes, but ducked and bowed and drew back, gathering up her poor charms and witcheries. When she had laid out the corpse as it should lie to be buried, on the left side with the knees bent, she had put in the upturned left hand a tiny charm bundle, something wrapped in soft goatskin and tied with colored cord. The wizard of Rayalby flicked it away with the tip of his staff. "Is the grave dug?" asked the wizard of Gauntport. "Yes," said the wizard of Rayalby. "It is dug in the graveyard of my lord's house." And he pointed towards the mansion house up on the mountain. "I see," said Gauntport. "I had thought our mage would be buried in all honor in the city he saved from earthquake." "My lord desires the honor," said Rayalby. "But it would seem," Gauntport began and stopped, not liking to argue, but not ready to give in to the young man's easy claim. He looked down at the dead man. "He must be buried nameless," he said with regret and bitterness. "I walked all night, but came too late. A great loss made greater." The young wizard said nothing. "His name was Aiehal," Tenar said. "His wish was to lie here, where he lies now." Both men looked at her. The young man, seeing a middle-aged village woman, simply turned away. The man from Gauntport stared a moment and said, "Who are you?" "I'm called Flint's widow, Goha," she said. "Who I am is your business to know, I think, but not mine to say." At this, the wizard of Rayalby found her worthy of a brief stare. "Take care, woman, how you speak to men of power." "Wait, wait," said Gauntport with a patting gesture, trying to calm Ray Albee's indignation, and still gazing at Tenar. You were his ward once?" "And friend," Tenar said. Then she turned away her head and stood silent. She had heard the anger in her voice as she said that word, "friend." She looked down at her friend, a corpse ready for the ground, lost and still. They stood over him, alive and full of power, offering no friendship, only contempt, rivalry, anger. "I'm sorry," she said. "It was a long night. I was with him when he died." "It is not," the young wizard began, but unexpectedly, old Auntie Moss interrupted him, saying loudly, "She was. Yes, she was. Nobody else but her. He sent for her. He sent young Townsend, the sheep dealer, to tell her come. Clear down round the mountain. And he waited his dying till she did come and was with him. And then he died. And he died where he would be buried, here." "And," said the older man, "and he told you?" "His name." Tenar looked at them, and do what she would, the incredulity on the older man's face, the contempt on the others, brought out an answering disrespect in her. "I said that name," she said. "Must I repeat it to you?" To her consternation, she saw from their expressions that, in fact, they had not heard the name, Ogeon's true name. They had not paid attention to her. "Oh," she said, "this is a bad time. A time when even such a name can go unheard, can fall like a stone. Is listening not power? Listen, then. His name was Aiehal. His name in death is Aiehal. In the songs, he will be known as Aiehal of Gaunt, if there are songs to be made any more. He was a silent man. Now he's very silent. Maybe there will be no songs, only silence. I don't know. I'm very tired. I've lost my father and dear friend. Her voice failed. Her throat closed on a sob. She turned to go. She saw on the forest path the little charm bundle Auntie Moss had made. She picked it up, knelt down by the corpse, kissed the open palm of the left hand, and laid the bundle on it. There, on her knees, she looked up once more at the two men. She spoke quietly. "Will you see to it," she said, "that his grave is dug here, where he desired it?" First the older man, then the younger, nodded. She got up, smoothing down her skirt, and started back across the meadow in the morning light. Kalesin. "Wait," Ogeon, who was Aehal now, had said to her, just before the wind of death had shaken him and torn him loose from living. "Over. All changed," he had whispered. And then, "Tenar, wait." But he had not said what she should wait for. The change he had seen or known, perhaps. But what change? Was it his own death, he meant? His own life that was over? He had spoken with joy, exulting. He had charged her to wait. "What else have I to do?" she said to herself, sweeping the floor of his house. "What else have I ever done?" And speaking to her memory of him, "Shall I wait here in your house?" "Yes," said Aehal the Silent, silently smiling. So she swept out the house and cleaned the hearth and aired the mattresses. She threw out some chipped crockery and a leaky pan, but she handled them gently. She even put her cheek against a cracked plate as she took it out to the midden, for it was evidence of the old mage's illness this past year. Austere he had been, living as plain as a poor farmer. But when his eyes were clear and his strength in him, he would never have used a broken plate or let a pan go unmended. These signs of his weakness grieved her, making her wish she had been with him to look after him. "I would have liked that," she said to her memory of him, but he said nothing. He never would have anybody to look after him but himself. Would he have said to her, "You have better things to do"? She did not know. He was silent. But that she did right to stay here in his house now, she was certain. Shandy and her old husband, Clearbrook, who had been at the farm in Middle Valley longer than she herself had, would look after the flocks and the orchard. The other couple on the farm, Tiff and Sis, would get the field crops in. The rest would have to take care of itself for a while. Her raspberry canes would be picked by the neighborhood children. That was too bad. She loved raspberries. Up here on the Overfell, with the sea wind always blowing, it was too cold to grow raspberries. But Ogeon's little old peach tree in the sheltered nook of the house wall facing south bore 18 peaches, and Theru watched them like a mousing cat till the day she came in and said in her hoarse, unclear voice, "Two of the peaches are all red and yellow." "Ah," said Tenar. They went together to the peach tree and picked the two first ripe peaches and ate them there unpeeled. The juice ran down their chins. They licked their fingers. "Can I plant it?" said Theru, looking at the wrinkled stone of her peach. "Yes, this is a good place, near the old tree, but not too close, so they both have room for their roots and branches." The child chose a place and dug the tiny grave. She laid the stone in it and covered it over. Tenar watched her. In the few days they had been living here, Theru had changed, she thought. She was still unresponsive, without anger, without joy. But since they had been here, her awful vigilance, her immobility, had almost imperceptibly relaxed. She had desired the peaches. She had thought of planting the stone, of increasing the number of peaches in the world. At Oak Farm, she was unafraid of two people only, Tenar and Lark. But here, she had taken quite easily to Heather, the goatherd of Realbi, a bawling-voiced, gentle lackwit of 20, who treated the child very much as another goat, a lame kid. That was all right. And Auntie Moss was all right, too, no matter what she smelled like. When Tenar had first lived in Realbi 25 years ago, Moss had not been an old witch, but a young one. She had ducked and bowed and grinned at the young lady, the white lady, Ogeon's ward and student, never speaking to her but with the utmost respect. Tenner had felt that respect to be false, a mask for an envy and dislike and distrust that were all too familiar to her from women over whom she had been placed in a position of superiority. Women who saw themselves as common and her as uncommon, as privileged. Priestess of the Tombs of Atuan, or foreign ward of the Mage of Gaunt, she was set apart, set above. Men had given her power. Men had shared their power with her. Women looked at her from outside, sometimes rivalrous, often with a trace of ridicule. She had felt herself the one left outside, shut out. She had fled from the powers of the desert tombs, and then she had left the powers of learning and skill offered her by her guardian, Ogeon. She had turned her back on all that, gone to the other side, the other room, where the women lived, to be one of them. A wife, a farmer's wife, a mother, a householder, undertaking the power that a woman was born to, the authority allotted her by the arrangements of mankind. And there in the Middle Valley, Flint's wife, Goha, had been welcome all in all among the women. A foreigner, to be sure, white-skinned and talking a bit strange, but a notable housekeeper, an excellent spinner, with well-behaved, well-grown children, and a prospering farm. Respectable. And among men she was Flint's woman, doing what a woman should do. Bed, breed, bake, cook, clean, spin, sew, serve. A good woman. They approved of her. Flint did well for himself after all, they said. I wonder what a white woman's like. White all over? Their eyes said, looking at her, until she got older and they no longer saw her. Here, now, it was all changed. There was none of all that. Since she and Moss had kept the vigil for Ogeon together, the witch had made it plain that she would be her friend, follower, servant, whatever Tenar wanted her to be. Tenar was not at all sure what she wanted Auntie Moss to be, finding her unpredictable, unreliable, incomprehensible, passionate, ignorant, sly, and dirty. But Moss got on with the burned child. Perhaps it was Moss who was working this change, this slight easing in Theru. With her, Theru behaved as with everyone, blank, unanswering, docile in the way an inanimate thing, a stone, is docile. But the old woman had kept at her, offering her little sweets and treasures, bribing, coaxing, wheedling. Come with Auntie Moss now, dearie. Come along, and Auntie Moss will show you the prettiest sight you ever saw. Moss's nose leaned out over her toothless jaws and thin lips. There was a wart on her cheek the size of a cherry pit. Her hair was a gray-black tangle of charm knots and wisps, and she had a smell as strong and broad and deep and complicated as the smell of a fox's den. "Come into the forest with me, dearie," said the old witches in the tales told to the children of Gaunt. "Come with me, and I'll show you such a pretty sight." And then the witch shut the child in her oven and baked it brown and ate it, or dropped it into her well, where it hopped and croaked dismally forever, or put it to sleep for 100 years inside a great stone, till the king's son should come, the mage prince, to shatter the stone with a word, wake the maiden with a kiss, and slay the wicked witch. Come with me, dearie. And she took the child into the fields and showed her a lark's nest in the green hay, or into the marshes to gather white hallows, wild mint, and blueberries. She did not have to shut the child in an oven, or change her into a monster, or seal her in stone. That had all been done already. She was kind to Theru, but it was a wheedling kindness, and when they were together it seemed that she talked to the child a great deal. Tenar did not know what Moss was telling or teaching her, whether she should let the witch fill the child's head with stuff. Weak as woman's magic, wicked as woman's magic, she had heard said 100 times. And indeed, she had seen that the witchery of such women as Moss or Ivy was often weak in sense, and sometimes wicked in intent, or through ignorance. Village witches, though they might know many spells and charms and some of the great songs, were never trained in the high arts or the principles of magery. No woman was so trained. Wizardry was a man's work, a man's skill. Magic was made by men. There had never been a woman mage. Though some few had called themselves wizard or sorceress, their power had been untrained, strength without art or knowledge, half frivolous, half dangerous.